All right, good morning. So, north of town, I was going like, I could only go about 35 miles an hour. It was raining so hard. So, we are late, and we are starting late. So, I do apologize about that. A couple things that I just wanted to mention while we get started here. The studies, the first two studies, are both up on the internet. I created a playlist in YouTube that's got the first two studies on it, and then this one will be added later this afternoon. So it's good to see Brad Marshy, guys. It's good to see you guys and everyone else as well. So what we've been doing for the last two Sundays is we've been talking about Codex Sinaiticus, and the reason we're doing that is I've kind of gone over the backstory. I don't really want to spend a lot of time on that necessarily today. And we've just sort of been looking at some things related to the age of the codex, whether the codex is really a 4th century codex. And so what we've done so far is we basically looked at two major points. I've laid out a timeline for you, and I'm going to do that again, but add some different stuff to it this time in a little bit. But we basically have looked at two points of significance, and that is the Shepherd of Hermas and then the Epistle of Barnabas. So what we've seen so far, just really quick, is that in 1844, Tischendorf supposedly finds the first, 43 leaves, and he takes them back with him to Germany, and those become known as Codex Frederico Augustanus, named after the King of Saxony that finances the trip. Tischendorf goes back to Mount Sinai in 1853 and he finds nothing. Okay? We've seen that in 1855-56, Simonides publishes a Greek copy of Hermas. Constantine Simonides publishes a Greek copy of Hermas. In 1859, Tischendorf goes back to St. Catherine's Monastery and he retrieves the remaining 315 some odd leaves, and this becomes known as Codex Sinaiticus. We've seen last week in 1860 that Constantine Simonides ends up in Great Britain to analyze some manuscripts that had been purchased by a guy named Joseph Mayer. And at that point, he's shown by B.W. Newton a copy of what Tischendorf is fixing to publish. He says, "I wrote that in 1862. In September 1862, Simonides writes the British newspaper The Guardian and says that he claimed to have written Codex Sinaiticus all the way back here in 1839-1840 at Mount Athos, Greece, as part of a project sponsored by his uncle Benedict. Okay, so we went over that stuff last time. We know that he publishes Hermas, a standalone copy of Hermas in 1856. We saw last time in 1843, he publishes a standalone copy of Barnabas. And so Simonides is responsible for two highly significant printings. Hermas and Barnabas are two of the distinguishing features of Codex Sinaiticus, and Simonides has published both of them before Tischendorf discovers anything. Okay? So all of that is sort of review, okay? Now, before we go on, does anybody have any just basic questions about all that? This is the second week in a row, third time now that you've seen some of this basic sort of timeline stuff, okay? So what I want to do to get started with this particular lesson is I actually want to show you a 5-minute, or have you listen to a 5-minute clip of James White talking about this, okay? So what I'm going to do is, everybody in this room should be able to hear this well enough, but I'm going to unclip my mic, this mic, and I'm going to set it next to the speakers on the computer so anybody that's watching on the internet could hear. That's not going to work. And I don't know if this is going to work either. So, Tom, our board meeting and whether or not stuff's working. Is that working?
It wasn't until I stepped out in the hallway and then picked up again, and it's working now.
Well, I'm not going to waste a bunch of time waiting for this to work. I can make my point without needing to show you that. So what I want to talk to you about today is essentially two things, assuming we have time to do it. And that is, I want to talk to you about some more details related to this, and then I want to start getting into some forensic evidence. Some of the forensic evidence about the codex itself. 2 weeks ago, Bud Chrysler handed me this pamphlet, or this booklet. This was put out by the British Museum in 1934, okay? And this is the second edition of a booklet that they put out shortly after they acquired the codex from the Russians, okay? Remember I told you that the cash-strapped Soviet Union sells the codex to the British Museum in the 1930s, okay? So when they got it, they put out a couple pieces of literature sort of talking about it a little bit. So before I read that to you, I want to remind you about something that James Farrar said about this in 1907 in his book Literary Forgeries. Okay, he says the fact that no visitor to the monastery at Mount Sinai before 1844 had ever seen or heard of such a work as belonging to the monks. Okay, so what Farrar is saying is that before Tischendorf supposedly discovers the first 43 leaves in 1844, is there any known record of anybody seeing this thing, of it being entered into the logs of the library at St. Catherine's Monastery? Is there any known record of this codex existing before Tischendorf sees it for the first time, supposedly in 1844? Farrar says what?
No.
He says there's no known record of that happening. Okay? So, back to the British Museum's piece here from 1934. There's a line in here, there's a couple lines in here that I want to read to you, okay? It's comparing Sinaiticus with Vaticanus. It says, whereas Vaticanus has remained safe for a period during the Napoleonic Wars in the security of the Vatican Library since the 14th century, and Alexandrinus ever since it was presented in 1627 to Charles I of England, and so forth. He says here, it says here that it is indeed likely, though not certain, so this is referring to Codex Sinaiticus, that it had been seen nearly a century before the Italian traveler, Valentino Donati. But it remained totally unknown to the world at large until, in May 1844, the great German scholar Constantine Tischendorf, during a visit to the monastery of St. Catherine's, found 129 leaves in a waste paper basket about to be consigned to the furnace, in which two other basketfuls, so told him by the librarian, had already been consumed. 43 of these leaves have been obtained as a gift and afterwards presented by him to the King of Saxony. Okay? So, Farrar says there's no record of anybody seeing it before when? 1844. This piece put out by the British Library said that somebody, this Italian guy, Valentino Donati, it says, may have, though not certain, he may have seen it 100 years before that. Okay? Dr. Daniel Wallace from Dallas Theological Seminary, this is put out by Chris Pinto. This is the guy who made the documentary that got all this conversation started back in 2002. But he put out a piece answering Dr. Daniel Wallace on Codex Sinaiticus and the Simonides affair. And he also talks about this explorer. And it says here, Italian explorer of 1761. Perhaps the most significant point made by Dr. Wallace is the assertion that an Italian explorer mentioned seeing Codex Sinaiticus in the year 1761 after a visit to St. Catherine's Monastery. Dr. Wallace tells us, quote, "In 1761, an Italian explorer, Valentino Donato, visited St. Catherine's and described a manuscript he saw there that matches Sinaiticus to a T." Okay? So is he claiming that the Italian... Is he making a much stronger claim about this than what the British Museum made in 1934? Okay? So he's saying this guy saw it, he described it to a T. This was 79 years before Simonides forged it and 59 years before Simonides were born. Then Pinto responds and he says, "If this were true, it would shatter the story of Simonides with a single stroke. But did the Italian explorer describe Codex Sinaiticus to a T, as Dr. Wallace asserts? An examination of Donato's journal entry reveals the contrary. Thankfully, the specific words he wrote are recorded by the British Library on their website under the history section of the Codex." Now, this is interesting, because do I already have a historical piece that was put out by the British Museum in 1934? Okay? The website says, quote, "The first written record of Codex Sinaiticus may be identifiable in the journal of an Italian visitor to the monastery in 1971. In it, the naturalist Valentino Donati reported having seen at the monastery a Bible comprising leaves of handsome, large, delicate, and square-shaped parchment written in a round and handsome script." Notice that the scholars at the British Museum tell us this may be a reference to Sinaiticus. They cannot quite, they are not quite as confident as Dr. Wallace. This is because Donato's description is relatively vague and can scarcely be as precise or to a T as Dr. Wallace has asserted. Donato's writings about the Bible he saw in terms, Donati writes about the Bible he saw in terms that might also apply to a thousand other works, depending on how a person identifies what it means to be, quote, handsome in the world of manuscripts. We should also consider that there are currently more than 3,000 manuscripts at St. Catherine's Monastery, and there may have been more back in 1761. And then he goes on to say that this guy, Donati, if he saw anything, he does not mention that it is a four-column codex. He does not mention the 23,000 marginal corrections. He does not mention the ending of the Gospel of Mark being missing from the Codex, and he does not mention the including of Hermas and Barnabas in the Codex. So in other words, whatever this guy saw, is it clear at all that he saw Codex Sinaiticus based on his own description of what he saw? Is everybody with that? Okay. Now, in the piece that I couldn't get to work, the 5-minute clip of James White, he's talking about this incident here where the monks are burning the parchment like we read about in the piece from the British Museum there. And Tischendorf is like, "Well, what are you guys doing?" And he starts looking through these so-called rummage bins of stuff they're about ready to burn. And he finds this thing that he considers to be this ancient codex. And what ends up happening is, you know, he makes a big deal about this, and then all of a sudden suspicion is raised that, oh, maybe we're about ready to burn this big valuable thing. And then the monks, you know, change their position. And this is the story according to Tischendorf. But what James White says in the video is that the monks aren't used to having this strange European Protestant dude in the library. Okay? So, I was doing some research, and I came across a book called Traveling Through Sinai. And there's an entry, there's a whole section in this book that titled The Library of the Convent. So these are descriptions of the library at Mount Sinai. Okay, there is an entry here by a guy named, it says, the library 1815. So this would be over here before any of this stuff, right? 1815. This is by a guy named William Turner. Okay? And he says, "To my inquiries after manuscripts and a library, the priest answered that they had only three Bibles, And I took their word the more readily, as Pollock states, they had no rare manuscripts. Okay? So this guy in 1815, he asks in the library about manuscripts. They say they have three what? They say they have three Bibles. Okay? And he believes them because of something that another guy, Pollock, stated. Okay? So I went back and I found Pollock. This is from a book called A Description of the East and Other Countries, Volume the First, Observations on Egypt. And this thing is dated from 1743, 100 years before this thing happens in 1844. Okay? So, as I'm looking at this, he's got an entire chapter on Mount Sinai. Okay? He's got drawings of the topography of the region, of the Mount Sinai region where St. Catherine's Monastery is at. He's even got the positioning of the monastery laid out and marked off for you as far as where it's at in relationship to the surrounding countryside. He's got maps of where it is. He's even got a map in here of the layout of the monastery. Okay, so this is all from 1743, 100 years before Tischendorf discovers anything. Okay, and so you go through this and you read all this, and I want to go to page 153, the top of this paragraph. Listen to what he says. He says, when pilgrims arrive at the convent. Now that is a very important statement. Why is that an important statement? Why is the statement when pilgrims arrive at the convent a very important statement?
Because Tischendorf was a pilgrim.
What's that?
Tischendorf was a pilgrim then?
Well,
they said that no pilgrims are known.
This establishes that, is this a religious pilgrimage site 100 years before Tischendorf discovers anything? So when James White talks about these monks not being used to outsiders being present in their midst, does he know what he's talking about? Okay, let me read more. When pilgrims arrive at the convent, a cloyer or lay brother is appointed to that is appointed to attend on them, to prepare their provisions in a place apart, which is which is served in their chamber. They are shown all the chapels and offices of the convent. So if a pilgrim to St. Catherine's Monastery, now think about that just for a minute. In the religious world, why would I want to go to St. Catherine's Monastery? Because this is where Moses supposedly got what? The Ten Commandments, right? And I could drink from the well of Moses, and I could do all this stuff, right, that religious pilgrims would want to do. So what this is establishing is that St. Catherine's Monastery has a long history of A, pilgrims coming to it, B, people being assigned to the pilgrims to not only see to their needs, but also give them tours of what? Of the monastery, right? So it says they are shown all the chapels and offices of the convent, the library, where there are a few manuscripts, but I saw none that were what? Rare. Okay? So here's a guy, 100 years before Tischendorf, saying that he went there, he got a tour of it, he looked around the library, asked in the library, and he didn't see any manuscripts in that library that are what?
Rare.
That are rare. Right? Tischendorf describes the Codex sitting out in the middle in a storage container for anybody to what?
See.
For anybody to see, right? So this guy says this in 1743, okay? So now I'm going to go back to the piece here by Turner, okay? Turner in 1815, he said, to my inquiries after manuscripts and a library, the priest answered that they had only three Bibles, okay? And I took their word the more readily, as Pollock states, that they had no rare manuscripts. So again, that's this guy right here that I just read to you. Okay? But Mr. Banks, and he's referring to a William John Banks who visited in 1813. So 2 years before this guy is describing his visit in 1815, okay? By preserving and rummaging, found out a library of 2,000 volumes. So the guy in 1813, he's poking around in there and he assesses that there's how many volumes? 2,000, right? 2,000 volumes, of which, lost my spot, of which 3/4 were manuscripts, and of these, 9/10 were Greek, the greater part were theological, but some were interesting. Mr. Banks bought away one, a thick manuscript containing Hesperiado on Greek matters and all the stuff that's not necessarily even related to the Bible. It's just ancient Greek philosophy and writing. Okay? So, is a guy there 100 years before Tischendorf? Yes. Is he shown the library? Does he see anything rare or startling or out of place, right? Is a guy there in 1813 and another guy there in 1815 that are able to spend enough time to know roughly what's in that library, how many volumes they have and all of that, right? And what do they report finding? Nothing. Do they have 3 Bibles? Could this Italian guy have seen something when he went in 1761? Yeah, but does that guarantee that he actually saw Codex Sinaiticus? Is everybody with that? In 1845, a Russian Orthodox archimandrite goes to St. Catherine's Monastery. So now this is the year after what?
Tischendorf.
Tischendorf finds the first 43 leaves in what year?
44.
Before this, have there been people there and a long history of pilgrims coming to the monastery, and is there anything of any value or significance reported of having been found as far as rare ancient biblical manuscripts?
No.
No. Okay. Tischendorf finds what he finds in 1844. The next year, a Russian archimandrite named Uspensky, Porfiry Uspensky, shows up. Okay. And he writes about this, so let me read this to you. Russian Orthodox Bishop Porfiry Uspensky described the Sinaiticus manuscript in his 1856 book, detailing his 1845 visit. So he writes a book in 1856 about when he went and when?
1845.
Okay. Now this is all written in Slovak, but it has been translated into English. Let me read to you what he describes. Okay. Pay attention to the details. He says, the best Greek manuscripts are stored in the prior's cells. Okay? There are only 4 of them. Now, the other guy before that, in 1813, said there were... 1813 and 1815 said there were how many?
3.
Now there's what?
4.
There are only 4 of them, and they are very precious for their antiquity, rarity, and handwriting features, their content, the elegance of the beautiful faces of the saints, and the entertaining drawings and paintings. Okay? Then listen to what he says. The first manuscript, containing the Old Testament, which was incomplete, and the entire New Testament, with the epistle of St. Barnabas and the book of Hermas, was written on the finest white parchment in 4 columns of a long and wide sheet. What is he describing?
Codex.
He is describing the Codex what? Sinaiticus. Okay? Now, has anybody before that point right there ever described seeing it? Have there been centuries of people coming and going out of the monastery, and has anybody ever said, there's this really valuable thing down there, you guys got to go check it out? Okay? So Uspensky in 45, he is describing looking at whatever he didn't what? Whatever he didn't take with him when he left in May 1844. Okay? So now in 1845, is there definitely something there? Okay? Now, there's a couple things you need to notice about that. Number one, they're described as being locked where? Locked in the prior cells. Why do you think that is?
Because they want to keep it secure.
Where did he describe it as being? Okay. Even in his story, does he say that when he expressed interest in what they had, he aroused the suspicion of the monks?
Yeah.
So now do the monks believe that they've got something? And so instead of just keeping it out where everybody can see it, now they start doing what? Locking it in the prior cells. Now this helps explain why when he comes back in 1853, he doesn't find what? He doesn't find anything because it's not where it used to be. They've what? They've moved it. Is everybody with that? Everybody with that? Amen. And the other thing is, now there are how many Bibles? Now there are four Bibles when back here in 1813, 1815, there were only how many Bibles? So, were there Bibles there, were there manuscripts there in 1761 for the Italian explorer to have found or seen? Yes. But that doesn't necessarily mean they were Codex what? Sinaiticus. Does Uspensky describe the particular details of exactly what we've observed as being contained in Codex Sinaiticus? Is everybody with that? Okay. And the other thing he says, if you didn't catch it, he says that it's on finest white parchment. Is everybody with that? Yeah.
I got a question. So then, in 1845, is it bound? Or because in 1844, apparently it was just...
That's if you believe Tischendorf.
Well, yeah. Okay, but then Tischendorf finds... So what did he take? He must have took something that wasn't in the other.
It's my personal opinion that he's not telling the truth.
Yeah.
And that he cuts out 43 leaves. That the thing is that he cuts it out and takes it with him.
So he takes out some of the Old Testament, must be
that. Yeah, he takes out some of the, he takes out 43 leaves of the Old Testament.
Okay.
Now the Old Testament was never complete to begin with, and there's a lot of stuff we can get into about that, but we don't have time at the moment to do that. But is everybody with this so far?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that the same as vellum then?
Parchment is vellum, yep. So what Uspensky describes seeing in 1845 matches exactly with what? With what we've observed as being the key distinguishing features of the Codex. It's four columns, it's on parchment, it contains part of the Old Testament, all the New Testament, Hermas, and what? Barnabas. Okay? Now, one more thing about Uspensky before we go back to... Just want to share this with you. After all of this, and him, Tischendorf getting the rest of it and coming back and it all starting to be printed and stuff like that, after the publication of the Imperial Edition in 1862, a Russian archimandrite, Porfiry Uspensky, who had seen the manuscript at Sinai between Tischendorf's second and third visit to St. Catherine's, but who had been unable to make use of the manuscript then, published a pamphlet entitled Opinion of the Archimandrite Porphyry regarding the Sinaitic manuscript, which contains the Old Testament incomplete and the whole of the New Testament and the epistle of the Holy Apostle Barnabas in the Book of Hermas, which attacks the orthodoxy of the Codex. So here's a Russian Archimandrite saying that the orthodoxy of the Codex should be called into question because it contains Barnabas and what? Hermas. And is he describing exactly what's in it? Okay? But then he goes on and he makes this really interesting statement here, okay? One can appreciate that Porphyry had reason to be chagrined that Tischendorf had succeeded in obtaining the manuscript when he had been unable to remove it from Mount Sinai. So the author of this book, J.K. Eliot, is saying, well, the reason why he's writing this is because he's just ticked that he didn't get to take it with him. Okay? Showing Unable to remove it from Sinai, but again, it is the tone of his criticism which is of interest, showing that there were certain features about Codex Sinaiticus, in this case, its text differing as it does so often from the Byzantine manuscripts. So this Russian Archimandrite is calling into question the authenticity of the Codex because of the wide variant readings that differ from the Byzantine text. And he's saying it is therefore what?
Fake.
It's not the true what? It's not the true text, he says. Okay? Then he goes on and he says, these relics have been exposed in the sight of the whole people of the capital in the, for the space of 2 weeks. And this people looked affectionately on the relic of Sinaitic antiquity and kissed it devoutly, knowing nothing of its heretical origin, neither perceiving any foul odor from it. I expect that Tischendorf, knowing well how dangerous this relic is for us, laughed in secret at our blissful ignorance. Ooh. That's interesting. Okay. Who brought up... Remember we were discussing the originals? And the attitude people would have if the originals still exist? And how they would kiss them and worship them and do all this stuff? What are the Russian people doing when this codex is put on display in public? They're doing exactly the thing that you would expect sinful men to do. Okay? Now, is everybody with all this so far? So that's 1845. 1846. Lord Lindsay. It's another British guy. 1846, Lord Lindsay, he says, in the Archbishop's apartment, now used as the treasury, we were shown a most beautiful manuscript of the Gospels in Greek on vellum in uncials, in uncial or capital letters of gold. I thought it good that this were in the British Museum. He talks about the illuminations and so on and so forth. I don't think he's talking directly here about Codex Sinaiticus because Codex Sinaiticus has no illuminations in it or drop caps. But the point I want you to get here is, again, he describes these things as now being kept where? In the Archbishop's what? Apartment. So, the shenanigans of Tischendorf in 1844, has it caused the monks at the monastery to change their practice and how they're dealing with this stuff? Okay? So when he comes in 53, he finds what? Nothing. When he comes again in 59, he has to almost, you know, cajole it out of them before they show it to him. And when they show it to him, guess where they take him to show it to him, according to Tischendorf? They take him into the prior's what?
Apartment
where he pulls it off the shelf and shows it to him. Okay? Is everybody with all that? Man, this just takes longer than I think it's going
to
take. Okay, now, so I want to go back to Simonides' own account, because I was asked some questions this week about how does the Codex get from Mount Athos, Greece, where him and Benedict and what was the calligrapher's name? Dionysius, I think. How does it get from Mount Athos to Sinai? Okay? So, let me find... All right. He said, so I'm quoting from what Simonides wrote to the paper, the British paper, The Guardian. He says, I therefore took possession of this book and prepared it by taking out the leaf containing the discourse. Now what he's talking about here is, remember that the goal here is to prepare a gift for the Tsar of who?
Russia.
So what Simonides claims is he went through the monastery there at Mount Athos and he found a fairly large codex that was relatively blank, that it only had a couple things written on it, and so he cut that out, and he started with a book that had blank sheets in it already, and then he transcribes onto that the what becomes the Codex Sinaiticus. Okay, so he says, I therefore took possession of the book and prepared it by taking out the leaf containing the discourse and by removing several others injured by time and moths, after which I began my task. First I copied out the Old and the New Testaments, then the Epistle of Barnabas, the first part of the pastoral writings of Hermas in capital letters or uncial characters, in a style known in calligraphy as, and then he gives some fancy Greek word, I don't know what it means. The transcription of the remaining apostolic writings, however, I declined because the supply of parchment ran short and severe loss which I sustained in the death of Benedict induced me to hand the work over to one of the binders of the monastery for the purpose of replacing the original covers made of wood and covered with leather which I had removed for convenience. And when I had done so, I took it into my possession. Okay? So before he's done, he runs out of parchment, number one, and number two, his uncle dies. Okay? So this is sort of like, okay, well, if the whole goal of this was for the uncle to get a printing press so he could print stuff, and now the uncle's gone, this sort of throws this whole thing into question, right? Sometime after this, having removed to Constantinople, I showed the works to the patriarchs, Adamantus and Constantius. Constantius, I guess. Okay? Now, one thing I want you to notice here, if he's lying, does he include a lot of details that he could be checked on? Most of the time when people lie, do they do this? No. Okay? So he says he goes to Constantinople and he shows it. He shows it to Adamantius and Constantius and communicates to them the reason for the transcription. So he tells it. He tells them what's going on. Constantius took it and having thoroughly examined it, urged me to present it to the Library of Sinai, which I accordingly promised to do. So he takes the thing when he's done from Athos, he takes it to Constantinople, he shows it to these two Greek Orthodox priests, and they tell him to take it where? They tell him to take it to Sinai. Okay? Now listen, Constantius had previously been bishop of Sinai. So this guy here had previously been the bishop of what? Sinai. Now I've got a note here. Constantius I of Constantinople was bishop of Sinai from 1805 to 1830. Okay? Simonides shows it to him. He's for 25 years, this guy has been bishop of Sinai. And when he sees it, what does he say? Simonides, how did you get our codex from Sinai? You thief. He's never seen it before, and he tells him to put it where? He tells him to put it there. Is everybody with that? This other guy, and then he was imperial patriarch from 1830 to 1834. The Adamantus guy, he was bishop of Constantinople from 1840 to 1841, and then again from 1848 to 1852. Okay? So Constantius, having previously been bishop of Sinai, and since his resignation of that office, had again become perpetual bishop of that place. Shortly after this, I was placed under the protection of the illustrious Countess Entlag and her brother, A.S. Strausus, by the companion of two patriarchs. But before departing for Odessa, I went over the island of Antilochus to visit Constantius, to perform my promise of giving up the manuscript to the library of Mount Sinai. The patriarch, however, was absent from home, and I consequently left the packet for him with a letter. On his return, he wrote me the following answer, quote, "My dearly beloved son of the Holy Spirit, Simonides, grace be with you and peace from God. I receive with unfeigned satisfaction your truly valuable transcription of the Holy Scriptures, namely, the Old and New Testaments, together with the Epistle Barnabas and the first part of the pastoral writings of Hermas, bound in one volume. which shall be placed in the library of Mount Sinai according to your wish. But I exhort you earnestly, if ever by God's will, you should return to the sacred Mount Athos to finish the work as you originally designed it, and He will reward you. But with me, of the third of the next month, I may give you letters, and it goes on and all this sort of stuff, right? But this explains how the thing gets from Athos to where?
Sinai.
To Sinai. Okay? Then he goes on and he talks about all these different people, places, and things. He talks about where he was. He talks about all these different things that happened to him. I'm running out of time here to cover all of this stuff. But is everybody following this so far? Is there any questions?
Just a comment. And my thinking is, it's significant that they describe it as the finest white parchment if it's supposed to be a century old.
It's a great question. You're anticipating nicely, Fred, where I want to go next.
Moved in front of the car. You don't have to do homework this week.
I got to remember next time to change the sleep settings on this thing. So, from the same letter, Fred, to the Guardian newspaper from September 1862. Simonides says that in 1850, so I'm going to have to put this up here, that in 1852, he says, in 1852, I saw it there myself, referring to St. Catherine's. In 1852, I saw it there myself and begged the librarian to inform me how the monastery had inquired it, but he did not appear to know anything of the matter, and I, for my part, said nothing. However, I examined the manuscript and found it much altered, having an older appearance than it ought to have. Okay, now remember, in 45, Uspensky said it was the finest white what?
Parchment,
okay? Now remember, what does Tischendorf do? He separates these 43 leaves from the rest of it and takes them back with him to Leipzig, Germany, and presents them as a gift, right? Now, so why is that important? Well, Fred, you actually brought up a great point that I want to get into here and use the internet for, okay? So, this is what I was talking about, getting into some forensic evidence, okay? Now check this out. I hope you can all see this. On the left, these are the sheets. These are photographs of the 43 leaves from 1844, Codex Frederico Augustanus. They are still to this day white. Okay? These leaves are from the 1859 St. Petersburg section. Now, are they the same color?
No.
They are not the same color. When Uspensky describes this in 1845, he says that it's what? That it's snow white parchment, right? And this is after Tischendorf took the first 43 leaves. Now, all of a sudden, when they show up over here, they look what? They look yellow, okay? Now, if that's not enough for you, let's look at a couple other things. Come on. So I'm going to go to parchment color. Now look at this. This is a photograph of every leaf in the whole codex. What do you see? You see how all of these are lighter color than the rest of them? All these light ones are the 43 leaves of Tischendorf took in 1844. Are you with that?
They're still white.
They're still white. Okay? The ones Tischendorf takes are what? The first ones he takes are still what? They're still white. The ones that he takes later on are now all of a sudden mysteriously a different what? A different color. Okay? Now, check it out, okay, just so you can see. Here are contiguous pages. Okay? Notice, so if you were looking in a book, this is the way this would lay in the book. This page is one color, the very next page is what? A different color. Okay? This one's even more visible. Check that. So this is one of the ones he cut out. This is one of the ones he what? He left, right? So physically, from a forensic analysis, the thing is not aged in a way that is even remotely... Look, if this is aged to this degree, why would the page immediately adjacent to it not be aged what? Accordingly. Unless these things had been separated from each other and somebody had messed with it. Okay? And there's another example here. There's two or three more examples here of these contiguous pages that are, you know, not the same what? Not the same color. Okay? So, this is from 1913. New Testament textual criticism, its history and results by James Alexander McGlaunt, page 44 in a footnote. When we read of Constantine giving, and that's talking about Emperor Constantine back in the day. I'm just going to cut to the chase for the sake of time. He said the latter was rescued from oblivion nearly 50 years ago, having been found in the monastery of St. Catherine's Mount Sinai by the famous critic Tischendorf, and now lies in the library of St. Petersburg. It was written on snow white vellum, supposed to have been made from the skin of antelopes. He says, see, it depends on which portion of it you saw. If you saw the part that was in Germany, it was what? It was white. If you saw the portion of it that was in Russia for a time, it wasn't what? It wasn't white. When Uspensky saw it in 1845, he described the whole thing. See, he sees it after he takes the first 43 leaves, and he says that the whole thing is still what?
White.
White. And then later on, you see the obvious funny business that's happened to the codex. Somebody took that thing and aged it to make it look what?
Old.
Okay? Any questions about that? Simonides himself says that when he saw it again in 52, that it didn't look like it should have looked. That it looked like somebody had messed with it to make it look what?
Aged.
Okay, now who do we know had their hands on it during that time frame? The only two people that we know that had their hands on it during that time frame, well, maybe three, were Tischendorf, Uspensky, and the monks at Sinai. Okay? Now you tell me who you think the most likely culprit is for who did something to it. Okay? How much time we got? Okay. A couple other things from a forensic standpoint. In its April 1863 edition, the Christian Remembrancer editorial asks a question which Eliot considers a telling, amusing point against Simonides, and the question is this: are the worm-eaten holes through the letters, or do the letters avoid the holes? Now, do you understand? If the thing is old and it was aged in a consistent way and moths got into it and worms got into it, they would have just eaten through the page and they didn't care what they would have what? Eaten through. Is everybody with that? Okay? So even this question is being raised in 1863 by the Christian Remembrancer. Okay? And this is becoming an important point. So I'm going to go back here.
So they rolled around the holes.
And I need choir 12. Folio 6. And I need do it. Probably only going to have time to show you one of these things. So just bear with me for a second. Okay, so, oh, there we go. So I want to draw your attention to this right here. Now, the Christian Remembrancer raised this point, right, in 1863. Notice how these two lines all of a sudden bend upward, and the letters all of a sudden get shorter so that they can miss what? The wormhole was already in the parchment when the scribe put the text on the parchment. Now again, does that match the story? What does Simonides say? He said that he found a codex of largely blank parchment. He said he cut out a little bit of writing and he cut out some leaves that had obvious damage on them, that were so damaged he couldn't use. And then he wrote on that parchment, right? So is he, whoever the scribe was, are they writing around the wormhole? Now, understand why that's important, right? Because if a worm got into this after the fact, would the worm have just gone through that page without any consideration whatsoever for what was written on that page? So whoever put the text on the page, did they clearly avoid the wormhole on purpose? Okay? Now, I think, I don't know if I'll be able to show you, but if I needed to turn this to the verso side. And if you go to the same section on the reverse side, you will notice that this word, this would be the opposite side, that this word is spelled and spaced out so that it misses the what? The wormhole. Okay? Now we could go on and on with this kind of thing. Okay? I have time to maybe show you one more example. Okay? So I'm going to go to Q38. Choir 38, excuse me. And Folia 1. And I want the versa side. Do you see why this putting this thing online has reopened up a whole thing here? Because now the whole world can see what was actually going on here in this particular codex. So I want column 4. Right there. You see that on this line right here, there's some kind of blemish right here? Mm-hmm. And you see that the scribe stopped this line short to avoid the blemish? Okay, one more. I know I said that already, but this one's hilarious. We're going to go to Choir 42. Folia 6. Versa. Column 2. Oops. Did it go? Oh, it's working on it. All right, while we wait for that, is everybody seeing? So you have a lot of different things going on here, right? You have the distinguishing features of the codex. You have the things that people have said about it. You have this, literally, does it appear that this thing just drops out of the clear blue sky in 1844? The only credible story to explain how this thing exists is the fact that Simonides what? Made it. The distinguishing features of the codex are in it. See, they know I'm looking at it, so they shut it down. Okay? But In the middle of all this, a friend of Simonides named Callinicos, he writes the British papers to try to exonerate his friend Simonides. And then, you know, have we already seen the British newspapers making a lot of stuff up and telling lies about Donaldson and about the Star of the East newspaper and about all these things that that could have been corroborated, right? So they get a letter. They publish a letter from a guy named Callinicos of Sinai, and he says the following. He says, he's talking about being the librarian of the monastery from the year 1841 to 1858, assured me, belonged to the library of the monastery and was marked in its ancient catalogs. So here's a guy claiming that the monastery at Mount Sinai has a catalog, and in the catalog from ancient times they have marked that they have possession of this codex. Now, why is this important? There's one real easy way to prove Simonides is lying. Just bring forth the codex or bring forth the catalog and prove that it was there. This catalog was never produced. Okay? Not only that, Simonides himself doesn't waste the opportunity. He says in a later letter, "I emphatically deny that the Codex Sinaiticus was inscribed in an ancient catalog for the good reason that no ancient catalog exists. There was none there, till I made a catalog during my first visit from the Patriarch of Constantinople, who was Bishop of Mount Sinai." So here's the point. If you want to disprove Simonides, just go get the catalog and what? But instead, they have to make stuff up, lie about him, say that he's forging all of this stuff. Now, just think about that just for 1 minute. They paint Simonides as the great, brilliant forger that's forging everything except the one thing he's claiming to have actually done. Just think about that. This isn't going to work, apparently, at this point. But I have one more thing to do, and we'll quit. When Callinicos writes to the British papers to corroborate his friend's story, they immediately accuse him of making up Callinicos and forging the letters as Callinicos, even though they had the appropriate postmarks from Alexandria, Egypt, and all this sort of thing, right? So, in 1895, Spirito Lambros did a catalog of Greek manuscripts on Mount Athos, Volume 1. In Volume 2, in 1900, he did the second volume of Greek manuscripts at Mount Athos. And right here, on page 454, is a record that Benedict Simonides and Callinicos were all on Mount Athos together working on a manuscript in 1841. So he did exist, he was real, and he was there when Simonides and himself said they were there. Independent corroboration of the point. All right? So we're running out of time. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah.
How much did the museum pay for that?
I don't know that factoid off the top of my head, but it was a few million bucks at least.
$100,000.
Yeah, it was a lot of money. And that's in the Depression, you know, that they're buying it. So
$500,000.
Yeah, something like, I don't know what that equates to in Russian money, but yeah. It was significant.
They don't want to see that thing turn into a fake.
They don't want to, and that's why. And they even say, I've got the article here. We don't have time to get into it, but they even say that the inks, the parchments, they've never been what? They've never been forensically tested. They've never subjected them to forensic analysis. They supposedly had a test scheduled in like 2015 and canceled it. Okay, we got to stop though. So.